Mexico's drug cartels teeter but don't fall. Today, Monday, February 24th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The capture of El Chapo Guzman was a major blow against one of Mexico's top drug cartels, but it raises tough questions. Will the cartels respond with more violence? And what sort of help are the drug lords getting from corrupt Mexican officials?
Tentacles all over the world, Europe, Asia, West Africa, South America, etc. You can't have that kind of power and not have some kind of collusion with the Mexican authorities.
And later, a different kind of drug trade, scouring the natural world for chemical cures.
You know, our ambition is to sample every species possible for drug discovery. We go wherever the human body can go.
Those stories and more after the news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Ukrainians don't quite know what comes next for their country, but they do know Viktor Yanukovych is no longer in control. The ousted president of Ukraine is on the run, as the new interim authorities in Kiev hunt for him. They've issued a warrant to have Yanukovych arrested on mass murder charges. Those charges stem from the killing of protesters during anti-government demonstrations last week. Yanukovych fled Kiev and his opulent presidential palace over the weekend. In a moment, we'll hear about one place where he could be right now, Crimea. First, though, The World's Matthew Bell has a look at the former president's rise and rapid fall.
Up until fairly recently, Viktor Yanukovych might have been described as a political survivor. He first ran for president in 2004. Widespread allegations of fraud and voter intimidation sparked huge protests. What followed was the Orange Revolution. The rivals of Yanukovych took power, but their popularity crashed and burned, and Yanukovych ran for president again in 2010. He won this time, but he very quickly started to dig his own political grave, says Alexander Motil of Rutgers University. Yanukovych did so by failing to bring members of the opposition into his new government.
Instead, he chose to appoint hardliners from within his own party to positions of authority.
That alienated many Ukrainians. Motil says Yanukovych followed up with two more big mistakes within the year. First, he signed a deal with Russia that gave Moscow long-term use of the Black Sea port at Sevastopol in exchange for cheap natural gas. The deal was widely criticized by Ukrainians. And second, Yanukovych changed the constitution to give himself sweeping presidential authority. Motil says that move set the stage for engaging in massive corruption.
What he did almost from the get-go was use the office as a means of enrichment for himself, his immediate family, and then the so-called family, with a capital F, which consisted of some 5, 10, 15 of his closest cronies. These people, according to estimates, embezzled something like $10 to $15 billion in the 3.5 or so years that they were in power. It's simply astounding.
Yanukovych helped bring about his own downfall last November when he broke long-standing promises to sign a major trade agreement with the European Union. Motil says much of the Ukrainian public had come to support the deal.
They saw this as a civilizational choice. That's the terminology that was used. Namely, that this was finally a choice that was being made by Ukraine to join Europe. And that means joining the world and kind of being like everybody else in the democratic capitalist world.
Hundreds of thousands of people came out to protest in Kiev and other cities, and Yanukovych might have sealed his fate once and for all with his heavy-handed response. Ukraine's opposition says the fugitive former president has blood on his hands. The former boxing champ turned politician Vitaly Klitschko said, "It's a remarkable situation when the president of Ukraine is trying to leave the country to avoid responsibility." Klitschko said Yanukovych is responsible for the hundreds of victims who died because it was he who gave the orders to disperse the protesters. Another Ukrainian opposition leader today warned that the Russian military might intervene to bring Yanukovych out of the country and take him under Russian care. Russia has now recalled its ambassador from Ukraine, and it says the unrest there is a threat to Russian citizens and Russian interests. The Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev described the ouster of Viktor Yanukovych as an armed riot. Frankly speaking, the Russian Prime Minister said, there is no one to communicate with in Ukraine. There is no government, he said. Yanukovych is now on the run. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Russia may sympathize with Viktor Yanukovych, but it appears unlikely that Moscow will actually come to the rescue of the ousted Ukrainian president. Last weekend, a prominent Russian state TV host accused Yanukovych of betraying the Ukrainian people. Dmitry Kisilov is known for his elaborate diatribes against the West. He did, in fact, also criticize the United States and European Union over their roles in the upheaval in Ukraine. But this weekend, he said that Yanukovych was ultimately to blame. Kisilov, who's seen as close to the Kremlin, said Yanukovych turned out to be incapable not only of working out a state strategy, but even of formulating the real national interests of the country. Moscow had been calling for a peace deal that would keep Yanukovych as president until a new election, but Kisilov's comments suggest that's off the table now. The consequences are irreversible, Kisilov said. Not exactly encouraging words for Yanukovych, who proclaimed on Saturday that he was still Ukraine's president. As we said earlier, he's on the run now. Some say he's in Crimea, the peninsula that juts out into the Black Sea. It's a part of Ukraine with deep ties to Russia. In fact, Russia still keeps a naval base there that was once home to the Soviet Black Sea Fleet. Some residents of Crimea even want to secede from Ukraine. Time magazine's Simon Schuster just spent 2 days reporting in this region by the Black Sea. He says that while we don't know for sure if Yanukovych is there, it would certainly be a friendly place for him to hide.
Well, Crimea is the only region of the country where the revolution has so far failed to take hold. Its ethnic makeup is distinctive in Ukraine because the majority of the population are ethnic Russians. So the loyalty to Moscow is often greater among the population there than it is to Kyiv.
Right. I mean, those rumors about secession, how real are they?
They're really only real in the city of Sevastopol, which is a very unique island of Russian nationalism. That Russian military base houses about 25,000 troops. It's a major military installation, and a good chunk, if not the majority of the population of the city, has family ties to the troops and also ties of friendship. So they are very upset and quite panicked at the revolution in Kyiv, which is a revolution that is quite anti-Russian.
Right. So you've got that kind of lean in to Moscow in Crimea. I mean, if you look at a map, it's about as far away from Kyiv as you can get and still stay in Ukraine. That might keep it insulated from any upheaval in Kyiv. How hardwired are those Soviet era roots in Crimea?
I mean, they run really deep, and it's not just Soviet. It goes back to the Russian Empire. And the people there really don't like the idea of any nationalists coming into power in Kyiv and telling them that they can't teach Russian in schools and implementing various laws that would, again, pull Ukraine and the Crimea towards Europe and away from Russia.
So given all these ties to Russia, what do you think the chances are of Russia intervening in the area?
I think the chances are still pretty small. So basically now Russia has an opportunity, just as it did in Georgia in 2008, to say, hey, hold on, we have Russian-speaking citizens. Some of them are actual Russian citizens who are in danger in Sevastopol, and we need to come in and make sure they're safe from the extremists and terrorists, as the Russian media and officials have put it, who have come into power in Kyiv. So they have that excuse, they have that pretext, and they have used that before. But I think considering the economic crisis that Ukraine faces right now, the new government, when they do come to power and they do establish some kind of order in Ukraine, they're going to have a hard time maintaining their popularity. So I think Russia's probably more inclined to take the longer view and say, let's see how they go for the next, you know, 2 or 3 years. And they may come around after all. Then again, you know, they might seek to take more aggressive measures. So far, the signals have been pretty unclear from Moscow.
It's an interesting kind of change of fortunes for Moscow, which was looking at Sochi, you know, like 48 hours ago, and suddenly things change. I mean, your own outlet, Simon, Time magazine, pulled you, like a lot of reporters, out of Sochi to get to Ukraine and follow what's going on there. And what's been the change of mood, climate, focus all been like for you?
I think a lot of the reporters in Sochi were mentally in Kyiv as soon as the violence broke out last week. We were all watching the live streams of the revolution in the press center in Sochi.
Time magazine Simon Schuster speaking with us from Kyiv. You might recall that Russia itself had a wave of political protests back in 2012 against President Vladimir Putin's third inauguration. In Moscow today, a Russian court sentenced 8 protesters who took part in those 2012 demonstrations. They were accused of rioting and attacking police. As Charles Maines now reports from Moscow, the case is being seen by many as a litmus test for Russia's tolerance of dissent, especially after the dramatic events in Ukraine.
If there were suggestions of a political thaw during Russia's Sochi Olympics, today's verdict seemed to show those hopes were illusory at best. Judge Natalia Nikishina read through the proceedings for hours before sentencing the activists to up to 4 years in prison. All the defendants deny attacking police. They say they merely interfered to prevent security forces from beating protesters. According to Vyacheslav Makarov, a lawyer for one of the activists, the defendants did not receive a fair trial.
Our arguments weren't included in the verdict. They weren't voiced or rebutted. The verdict did not reflect them.
Today's ruling once again raises questions about how much the Kremlin will tolerate dissent in Russia. Outside the courthouse, the answer again seemed to be not much at all. Russian-owned security forces rushed into a crowd of more than 1,000 protesters, arresting scores of people, sometimes at random and sometimes not. Pussy Riot members Nadia Tolokolnikova and Maria Lyokhina were both detained, as was a man in a chicken costume. Lev Rubinstein, a Russian writer active in the protest movement, admitted the situation was grim.
We're too few here. If they have enough buses to take us all away, they win, temporarily. I still think we're moving in the right direction, but slowly.
What they do now, they give the same prison terms to them as they did to us. They just changed the number of the article of a criminal code.
Andrei Mironov is a former dissident who spent time in prison in the Soviet Union. He says the only hope for Russia's beleaguered opposition movement is the success of post-revolutionary Ukraine.
And I hope in America and Europe people understand that the best way to help democracy in Russia is to help Ukraine.
Recent events in Kyiv were clearly on the minds of many here today. One man held up a sign that read Maidan, as in Ukraine's independent square. Protesters cheered him on. Others taunted Russia's security forces with chants of Berkut, the name of the once-feared security forces of Ukraine's ousted president, Viktor Yanukovych. Still, Alexei Navalny, the anti-corruption blogger who emerged as a leader of Russia's opposition movement, urged Russians to avoid seeking parallels with Ukraine.
Maidan is not important here. Maidan was in another country. Citizens of another country were fighting for their freedom. The question is now for us whether we are ready to fight for our freedom. That's all.
Only Navalny would have to fight for that freedom another day. Soon he, too, was under arrest. For The World, this is Charles Maines in Moscow.
PRI.org is where we live online when we're not on the radio. But there are lots of other ways to find the world. Take the Flipboard app. The app takes our radio show and basically turns it into a magazine whose pages you can flip through and at the same time hear all the voices you know from the world. It's a wonderful thing, and it runs on your iPad, iPhone, or Android device. You can find it at flip.it/PRI. That's flip.it/PRI. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Mexico's most notorious drug cartel leader was formally charged today. As you probably heard, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman was captured over the weekend. The end of a 13-year manhunt for Guzman came in a hotel room in Mazatlan on Mexico's Pacific coast. It was a joint operation involving both Mexican and American agents. U.S. officials quickly vowed to seek Guzman's extradition. But today's charges probably mean Mexico will get the first crack at trying the cartel leader. Alfredo Corchado is covering the story. He's Mexico bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News and author of the book Midnight in Mexico.
Well, it's a huge, huge break for Mexico. I mean, it's been kind of an electrifying weekend, but also kind of a weekend of nervousness. There's fears that there's going to be a new onslaught of violence. You can't have this kind of a power vacuum and just say, oh, it's over, Chapo's caught. Someone's going to try to fill that vacancy. But it's also, you know, the Sinaloa cartel is the oldest, the most powerful cartel. I'm sure they have a succession plan. But there's still fears that, at least in the short term, you might have some readjustments.
Mm. Guzman's arrest was carried out by an elite group of Mexican Marines. Can you tell us who the Mexican Marines are and what their reputation is?
Well, Mexican Marines in the last few years have really emerged as the most trustworthy agency for Americans to work with. I mean, there's a joke in Mexico that they are not as corruptible because they're in the middle of the sea. It's hard to reach them, hard to corrupt them. What's really unusual about this operation, Marco, is that it was carried out by Marines, but also U.S. Marshals, Homeland Security, people on the ground. And that is really unusual. And that also, I think, takes away the suspicion that maybe the new president, Enrique Peña Nieto, didn't want to work with the Americans. I think this lays to rest some of that criticism that we've been hearing for the last 14 months.
You know, there have been so many allegations of collusion between the drug cartels and Mexican authorities, and it's an issue you've been exploring, Alfredo. If that collusion has been going on, what happened in all these relationships for Guzman, the capo of all the capos, to get caught?
Marco, that's really the most fascinating question here, because now that he's caught, will we be able to see that collusion, the extent of that collusion? If we don't know more than, he was this mythical Robin Hood figure. If we don't know more than that, then this is really only a partial victory for Mexicans. I mean, I think if they're serious about trying to clean up the system, really get to the bottom line, understanding who the politicians were, who were the agencies, who in the military, who in the government was involved, will be a big, big victory and will be unprecedented.
And Alfredo, I mean, is there an assumption that Guzman was colluding with the Mexican government, or is there actual kind of strong evidence that this was happening?
Well, there's been strong allegations for many years. You cannot become the world's most powerful cartel. The Sinaloa cartel, for example, they're credited with smuggling more than 25% of the cocaine into the United States, and their reach is tentacles all over the world, Europe, Asia, West Africa, South America, et cetera. You can't have that kind of power and not have some kind of collusion with the Mexican authorities.
I'm curious, too, given just the spread of Guzman's empire, how involved he was in the day-to-day running of that whole operation. Like, did he ever travel to Asia or West Africa to see how things were going?
We have no evidence of that. I mean, there's been a lot of reports in the past that he was seen in Argentina, he was seen in Central America, he was seen in other countries, Venezuela. And there are some U.S. officials who will debate that and say, he had, in the latter years, he had become more the figurehead. The real brains behind the organization is a guy named Ismael Mayo Zambada and a guy named Esparagosa, also known as El Azul. Those guys may be the ones who are now trying to figure out, who succeeds, what happens next to the Sinaloa cartel. Mm. But this is obviously a huge, huge hit, a big blow to the cartels. And hopefully in the long term, you'll be dealing with much more smaller organizations, which is really what I think what the United States and other countries have been telling Mexico. It's easier to deal with the smaller ones. It may get bloody in between, but in the long run, it's easier to deal with the small cartels than the huge, powerful cartels like Sinaloa cartel.
Alfredo Corchado, Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, speaking with us from Juarez. Thanks very much, Alfredo.
Thank you, Marco.
Very few women have ever been involved in Formula One or F1 car racing. It's mostly a man's world, but Susie Wolf isn't letting that bother her. She's a development or test driver for British racing team Williams, and she's just found out that she's been picked to drive in an upcoming F1 practice session. To put that in perspective, the last time a woman drove in an F1 practice session was 1992. And the last time a woman was behind the wheel in an actual F1 Grand Prix was back in 1976. 31-year-old Susie Wolf says racing in Formula One has long been a dream of hers.
I started racing when I was only 8 years old. And many of the Formula One drivers of this day started at such a young age. And you come through the various ranks of motorsport, from karting to kind of Formula Three. And then we're all aspiring to eventually get onto that Formula One grid.
You started out with karting, like go-karts?
Like go-karts, yeah.
A lot of people do that in Scotland?
Sure, it's massive. I think not just in Scotland, but worldwide. I started with a little motorbike when I was only two because my dad runs his own motorbike shop. And with eight, I started karting at club level and then in Scottish championships, then in the British championships, and then in the European. And at 18, I was ranked 15th in the world.
Why? What do you like about going fast?
Oh, I think it's not just about going fast. It's the speed, it's the adrenaline, it's the competition, it's the pushing yourself to your absolute limit. I'm in the fight. These things combined is what makes racing and being a racing driver so fantastic. It's always been my passion.
You're technically what's called a Formula One development driver. What does that mean?
Well, testing is banned in Formula One. It's part of the regulations, which means it's hard for the teams to develop the cars as much as they did in the past, because at the factory in the Williams team, we have 580 people building two race cars. So obviously the fact that we can't test is quite restrictive, but it's the same for every team. So my role as a development driver is predominantly based in our very high-tech simulator. I also do all the aerodynamical tests, but I did a full test day in the race car in July because it would be quite difficult to give feedback only on a simulator if I hadn't driven the actual race car to know what it's really like. So I'm a racing driver, you know, I want to be in a racing car and I want to be out on a track. So any chance that I can to be out on track in the Formula One car, then I grab it with both hands.
Describe for us what it's actually like driving in a Formula One car. I mean, how many things are going through your brain at once?
It's very mentally tough because there's so much to get right while you're in the car. And obviously you're going at such a high speed that your reactions have to be very, very fast. But you're very well prepared for it because it's so technical and it's so much expected of you. The team makes sure that you're very well prepared for that. So I can remember vividly my first lap out on track going along the hangar straight of Silverstone and reaching over 300 kilometers an hour. You feel like your helmet is going to get pulled off your head because the G-force is so high. And it's really an incredible feeling to drive that car. It's the most technologically advanced car in the world. And to drive it is something very special.
Yeah, that's over 180 miles per hour. How do you psych yourself up for dealing with the dangers of any course?
I'm what I love. Of course, it's dangerous, but I never have fear. I have respect for the car and the races that I compete in, but never fear. And as long as that continues, I keep racing. And as soon as I would have fear in the car, I think that's the time to stop.
Formula One development driver Susie Wolf there. And next July, she'll be on that track again ahead of the British Grand Prix, the first woman to do so in 22 years. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, the director of a new documentary about the Vatican's darker side explains what drew him to the story.
My own sort of religious life has been fraught, full of self-examination, full of extraordinary experiences. It's always of enormous concern to me, and it's my own personal searching as well as anything else.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. If you thought the fictitious The Da Vinci Code exposed the Vatican's dark underbelly, wait till you see Secrets of the Vatican tomorrow night on PBS. It's a documentary by our partners at Frontline, focusing on the collapse of Pope Benedict's reign. The film puts that collapse in the context of years of Vatican power struggles, the clergy sex abuse scandal, and corruption at the Vatican Bank. Director Anthony Thomas says it all proved to be too much for Pope Benedict.
He tried very hard, but in the final years, he just was not well enough to cope with this. Old age had overtaken him. He sincerely wanted to clean up the bank, very, very much, and he wanted to deal with a lot of abuses in the Curia. He was a good man, he was a pious man, but he just didn't have that strength, which I think Francis has. I think he's got amazing vitality.
But really, you think Pope Benedict resigned because of a lack of vitality? Was that it?
Yes. I mean, he was thinking of resigning from early 2012, before the VatiLeaks thing got really serious and before all these scandals came out. But it is said that Cardinal Bertone persuaded him to postpone.
Cardinal Bertone, who is really his right-hand man, his Secretary of State.
And
remind us the full scope of VatiLeaks, this big scandal that blew up in Rome.
Thousands and thousands of confidential documents from the Pope's own personal office that were released to the journalist Nuzzi. It revealed one thing after another. I mean, cronyism, pedophilia, financial misconduct, all kinds of things within the Vatican Curia, the Vatican bureaucracy.
How do you think all of these scandals colored Benedict's papacy?
Well, unfortunately, they happened on his watch, and it was very unfortunate, and led, I think we all agree, to his decision to resign. He just couldn't cope with it anymore. And it would be sad if, in future decades, he is only remembered for that aspect of his papacy.
There's a warning before this documentary airs that some people might find some of the things in here pretty controversial and provocative. Why did you unpack in such excruciating detail some of the abuses? You really have your interviewees going to pretty disturbing detail about what happened to them. What do you think we actually gain from that?
I think we gain a lot. I mean, take one interview, the interview with Monica Barrett. She not only explains what happened to her, but what she reveals is how much more terrible it is if you're abused by a priest. If you are a young, believing Catholic and you're abused by a priest, how much more terrible that is than abuse by any other adult. He, as she puts it so beautifully, is your link with God through him, and he is the man who turns on her.
Yeah, well, we're certainly impacted by Monica's account of what happened to her. Here's an excerpt.
It was a Saturday, and I was 8 years old, and my father took my younger sister and I, and we drove out to Lake Geneva to visit with this priest, William Effinger. At one point in the day, Father Effinger said he needed help in the church with candles, and my father said, "Go help him." And we went into the church, where he assaulted me for a period of time, and ultimately ended up raping me.
Anthony, what was your interest in making this documentary?
My own sort of religious life has been fraught, full of self-examination, full of extraordinary experiences. It's always of enormous concern to me, and it's my own personal searching as well as anything else.
There's this kind of shocking scene, very kind of inside edition, where we are in a gay bar in Rome with some priests who are quite open about this dual life they lead. And that hypocrisy seems to be kind of at the center of much of the criticism of the Catholic Church. Now that Francis is Pope, is undoing that hypocrisy just too big of a job for one man?
I don't think it is. And I think his statements on homosexuality, he has been in touch and conversed with gay groups. He's also uttered that famous phrase, "Who am I to judge," when asked about homosexuality. Benedict was so strong on the idea that the main problem behind the whole sexual abuse issue was the homosexuals in the church. He engineered a change in the catechism to make the actual condition of homosexuality was wrong, regardless of whether you lived a celibate life or not. And when things are repressed like that, they come out into the open in very undesirable ways.
Well, Anthony Thomas, thanks so much for coming in.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Anthony Thomas is the director of Secrets of the Vatican, which airs tomorrow on PBS. The people of Libya have been marking the third anniversary of their uprising against Muammar Gaddafi, but things are still unsettled there. The Libyan government is weak and militias control parts of the country. Last week, Libyans finally got the chance to vote to elect people who will draft a new constitution. It's not clear, though, that the vote will mean much to one group of Libyans. They face retaliation at the end of the revolution and are still suffering today. Marine Olivezi went to visit them.
We're at a polling station on the outskirts of Tripoli. It's pretty quiet so far. The ballot box actually looks quite empty. Unlike in 2012, these elections are not drawing big crowds. There's only about a third of Libyans who've registered to vote across the country. But here, the residents have some very specific misgivings about Libya's transition. And that's because this polling station is actually inside a refugee camp.
I'm a refugee. I can't say it is good, this is freedom, revolution, good, that is good. Good about what? Peace, but not good.
Mabrouk Iswezi comes from Tawarga, a small town now empty of its residents. all 40,000 of them had to flee Tawarga at the end of the revolution. Eswezi says they were on the wrong side of the uprising against Muammar Gaddafi.
We all Tawargan people say, long live Gaddafi. All Tawargan people love Gaddafi. Gaddafi doing something is good for Tawarga.
Things like building houses in Tawarga or giving scholarships to study abroad, he says. Tawargans are the descendants of African slaves who settled in Libya generations ago. Eswezi says they're a traditional rural tribe. Gaddafi liked their simple manners and sometimes paid them a visit on his way to his hometown of Sirte. During the revolution, Gaddafi's forces occupied Tawarga schools and public buildings, and Eswezi says for the most part, locals welcomed them. Many young Tawargans even joined Gaddafi's troops. The town became a rear base for the army in the months-long siege of Misrata, some 18 miles away.
Gaddafi and the volunteers from Tawarga go to Misrata, attack Misrata, attack houses Misrata, and come back to stay in Tawarga.
In the summer of 2011, the tables turned. Rebel fighters finally broke the siege of Misrata. Gaddafi troops fled, and so did the Tawargans.
When the revolution attacked us in our area, all Tawarga leave Tawarga, all Tawarga people leave Tawarga in this state. We feel in Misrata forces want to kill us. They attacked us in the desert, in the road. When we leave, they attacked us.
For militias in Misrata, it was payback time. Tawarga was torched. Scores were arrested. Many were killed. Human Rights Watch has called the collective punishment of the Tawargans a crime against humanity.
Misrata have suffered a lot during the revolution. But this is no excuse, of course, for Tawarga also to suffer.
That's Libya's Justice Minister, Salah Al-Margani.
I hope anyone who is committing a crime against humanity would be brought to trial. Maybe not now, maybe not today. But once Libya stabilizes enough, I think we would be able to prosecute those people. However, our highest priority now is to save people, to save lives, and to make sure that people are not subjected to revenge.
Misrati's desire for revenge was in part fueled by allegations that some Tawargans committed mass rape during the siege of Misrata. Al-Margani says reconciliation will only be possible when these cases are brought to justice, but Libya's new judicial system is still limping, and these claims are hard to address.
In this country, we have no experience of dealing with mass rape issues. We have no record of mass rape cases. We so far failed to address the issue of the victims. This is a very important aspect.
In the meantime, hundreds of Tawargans are still being held without trial in Misrati jails. Al-Margani says the long overdue transfer of prisoners to state-run facilities will accelerate the justice process, and he hopes ultimately Tawargan civilians will be able to return to their hometown. But for now, displaced Tawargans say they feel forgotten in the new Libya. Zahra and her family fled Tawarga in August 2011 and found refuge in Tripoli. A month later, her husband was stopped at a checkpoint. His body turned up at a hospital in Misrata a month after that. Zahra says her husband was just a civilian who was stopped because he was dark-skinned, and he was tortured and killed because he was from Tawarga. On election day, Zahra was too busy to even think of voting. In small rooms just feet away from the polling station, Zahra and a dozen women face huge piles of dates. They're picking the good ones and putting them in boxes. If Zahra fills 90 of them in a day, she earns a little less than $10. Elections or not, she says, things cannot change soon enough for her and her family. For The World, I'm Marine Olivesi, Tripoli, Libya.
When I say jungle or coral reef, the first thing you think of is, okay, probably not medicine. But for three decades, a hunt's been underway, on land and at sea, for molecules that could help fight cancer. An important part of that hunt is about to wind down. But before it does, The World's Ari Daniel headed off to Maryland and the Pacific Island nation of Palau to check in with scientists who've been part of it.
You need chemicals to fight cancer, and chemists have spent decades making molecules they hope will fight everything from breast cancer to prostate cancer. But all the chemists in the world, they're no match for Mother Nature.
Mother Nature has been doing her chemistry for 3 billion years. Chemists have been doing chemistry for under 300 years.
David Newman heads up the Natural Products branch at the National Cancer Institute in Frederick, Maryland, which means that for the last three decades,
I have been persuading molecules to come out from strange sources.
The reason for all this persuasion is that most organisms use chemistry to defend themselves against all kinds of threats, from the sun's radiation to parasites.
Mother Nature's been working for a very long time to make molecules that we couldn't have dreamed of.
Researcher Matthew Harris says it's often faster and easier to harvest the contents of nature's chemical treasure chest than to create complex cancer-fighting molecules from scratch, which is what sent marine scientist Pat Colin to locations across the tropical Pacific.
I'm going to have to back up here before we crash.
Colin positions his small boat near a tiny rock island in Palau. He runs the Coral Reef Research Foundation, an outfit contracted by the National Cancer Institute to gather marine samples from across the Pacific. Over the last two decades, his team has collected thousands of samples of things like soft corals, sea squirts, and marine worms.
You know, our ambition is to sample every species possible for drug discovery. We go wherever the human body can go.
Cullen's taken his body diving 500 feet down into the sea. He's wedged himself into narrow crevices, and he's grabbed a sponge that made him itch for a week. He and his team sample literally everything they can get their hands on. From the water, the samples are brought back to a local lab where they're shipped to the U.S. for processing. But that's not necessarily the end of the story for Palau and other host countries.
To me, it's kind of opened my eyes to the diversity of things in the water.
Emilio Basilios is a Palauan who works for the foundation. He tells people his job involves looking for medicine in the water. And Pat Colin says just having an inventory of what's in the water is really important in this part of the world.
We're cataloging habitats, providing in many cases the first knowledge of which organisms are occurring in those habitats.
He says knowing that potentially useful products could come from these natural areas can give countries an incentive to conserve them. Back in Maryland, an NCI technician uses a chisel to break apart a large frozen sponge from Palau. He then sends the chunks down the throat of a meat grinder, which pulverizes them into what feels like an icy flour.
Probably a little more like pastry crumbs, except that I would not make a tart out of this.
David Newman says this powder will be processed and exposed to 60 different tumor cell lines. If researchers spot any promising anti-cancer activity, the NCI will patent the compound and license it to a private company. That firm then has a year to reach an agreement with the host country. Now, even with that vast treasure chest of natural compounds, finding something promising is rare. In 30 years of collecting, the hit rate's been less than 1 in 10,000. Researchers say it's worth all that effort to find things like Taxol and camptothecin, two cancer drugs that came from trees. Newman says these days, the most promising organisms are sponges and a group of colorful mollusks called nudibranchs. But exploring the rest of nature's chemical treasure chest will have to wait. Money for the project has gotten scarcer, so collecting from places like Palau is being put on hold. Working up the samples in the lab, however, researcher Matthew Harris says that's likely to continue for decades.
The job's never going to be done. The goal is to make a representation of all of nature that can be looked at for whatever investigation is going.
Investigations that ultimately go beyond cancer to a host of other diseases. One day, this frozen collection of pulverized organisms from the other side of the planet might just contain a chemical that saves someone's life. For The World, I'm Ari Daniel, Frederick, Maryland.
Ari's story was reported with help from the Solutions Journalism Network. You're listening to The World from PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Today we're launching a series we're calling The Ninth Month. It's a look at pregnancy and childbirth and at how women experience that critical time in their lives. It varies dramatically across the globe. For instance, here in the U.S., doctors often encourage expectant mothers to exercise. Staying active can be good for mother and baby. But in other parts of the world, strenuous manual labor is the norm. And there it can be a challenge to give pregnant women a rest. The world's Sonia Narang has our story from Nepal.
In Nepal, it's the women who do the backbreaking work in the fields. In the mountain village of Pawati, Januka Rasali plants vegetables on her farm. After an hour, she treks back home to chop wood. Before long, she's herding goats on a hillside under the hot sun.
From the moment I wake up at 6 in the morning until I go to sleep at 10 at night, I'm doing work the whole time. I work about 7 or 8 hours a day in the fields.
Januka is 7 months pregnant. Despite her expanding belly, her chores will not let up.
Up until the day the baby's born, I'll be working all the time.
In recent years, Nepal has made a big push to improve the health of pregnant women. The government has built new birthing centers. It's covered the cost of delivering babies in clinics. It's given out medication to prevent excessive bleeding, which can be fatal. And these efforts are working. The country has seen a dramatic drop in the number of women dying during childbirth.
The challenge still is, can we even lower it further?
Arzu Rana Duba is a member of parliament and women's health advocate in Nepal. She says a big remaining problem is that so many women work so hard late into their pregnancies. Now, exercise is recommended during pregnancy. But experts say in regions where women don't get good prenatal care or may not eat enough calories, strenuous activity can cause serious complications. The reason pregnant women work so hard in Nepal, Duba says, is a matter of poverty and culture.
That's the concept women in Nepal are mostly socialized in, that you have to make your presence felt and your worth is the labor you contribute. They are taught to think of themselves as responsible for this kind of work because they have the lowest status inside the family, so they need to do the hardest labor.
Januka, the pregnant woman who works all day long, crouches in her smoky kitchen and blows air into a wood-fired stove. Then she dices and grinds vegetables while breathing in swirling ashes. She says she wishes she could take a break from the hard work at least once in a while.
My back hurts. My stomach hurts. While planting corn and rice a month ago, my legs got swollen and cramped. My body is in constant pain.
Health experts say women like Januka should take a break. In extreme cases, hard work in late pregnancy can cause the uterus to slide out of its normal position. But how do you convince women to slow down in a society that values them for their productivity? Carolyn Miles heads the international aid group Save the Children.
What you have to reinforce is that the health of the mother has a direct impact on the health of that baby.
In other words, even if husbands and mothers-in-law may not worry much about the mother's health, they're often extremely concerned about the baby's health. So organizations like Save the Children are meeting with families and appealing to their concern for the baby's welfare to give pregnant women a much-needed rest.
Now what we're seeing is mother-in-laws step forward and say, you know, I'm going to actually go, you know, take care of the garden for the next month, or I'm going to make sure that my daughter-in-law gets the right food and enough food, which is a big shift.
And behaviors are changing for husbands as well. When Januka was pregnant with her first child, her husband was away from home. But this time he came back to the village to help her through her second pregnancy. Madhav says he returned to protect the health of his wife and unborn child.
When my wife is working in the fields and she says she has a stomachache, I get scared. I was worried during my wife's first pregnancy, and I'm scared again how it will go.
And so he helps with the chores, at least a little. On this day, Januka's husband shovels mud in a rain-soaked field while she plants seedlings in the holes. In the past, she says she had to do all the digging herself. During my previous pregnancy, I worked a lot harder, she says. This is nothing in comparison. For the World, I'm Sonia Narang, Pavati Village, Nepal.
Sonia Narang's trip to Nepal was funded by the International Center for Journalists. Sonia joins me now in our Boston studios. Welcome back, Sonia.
Thanks, Marco.
Now, you weren't only producing radio stories in Nepal. You also produced some videos, and there's one online now, a beautiful short film you made about Janaka, the woman we just heard from. What really struck me is why she allowed such an intimate portrait of her life to be made known. Is she hoping that things will change if journalists like you tell her story?
Well, when I first met Janaka in the village, she was very open to sharing her story. And yes, she wanted people around the world to know how much labor these women have to do during their pregnancy and also after they give birth. There really is no break for them even after their babies are born.
Now, it's been several months since you met with Janaka. The video you made has, unfortunately, an update, a sad update.
Yes. So after I returned, I called Janaka and I found out that Janaka's baby girl did not make it. She ended up giving birth at home and there were no birth attendants there. And the baby's umbilical cord got tangled around the neck and the baby did not survive. There was no one there to help.
Is it possible to know, Sonia, whether the baby's death was at all related to the hard work that Janaka was doing late in her pregnancy?
So I asked Janaka and her husband about that, and they said that this was completely unrelated to the hard work. This was just a situation of there not being any doctors, any medical personnel available in the village, and also the fact that there was no transportation to get them to the nearest hospital. So it wasn't related to the hard work that she was doing.
Other layers of a very big problem. Well, Sonia's story today about Janaka launches a series we'll be continuing over the next few months, looking at pregnancy and childbirth around the world. We're calling the series The Ninth Month. As for your video, Sonia, listeners can watch it at our series webpage. That's pri.org/ninth month. And listeners can also chat with you on Facebook tomorrow, right, Sonia?
Yes, that's right, Marco. So I'm going to be online tomorrow starting at 11 a.m. Eastern. We're doing a live Facebook Q&A, and you can find that link on our series page, which is pri.org/ninth month. And my journalist colleague in Kathmandu is also going to join us on the Facebook Q&A to take your questions. We'd love to hear from you, and we'd love your comments about pregnancy in Nepal tomorrow.
The world's multimedia producer, Sonia Narang. We'll see you tomorrow on Facebook.
Thanks, Marco.
And we'll see you back here tomorrow on the radio. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks, by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. The Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael and Anne Cerisi.
PRI, Public Radio International.